Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Real Estate Coaching Radio, America's number one trusted resource for realtors who demand authentic, real-time coaching. Starring award-winning real estate coaches Tim and Julie Harris. Get ready for unfiltered, full-strength honesty about what is truly working to get you into action and make you money in this new real estate boom. Now to our hosts, Tim and Julie Harris.
We're joined today by Michael Gordon from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Fox & Roach Realtors, serving the Philadelphia metro area. For nearly the past 15 years, Michael Gordon has been the in-house marketing director for his wife and partner, Robin Gordon. Michael is responsible for the fast response seller marketing campaigns, experienced with integrated marketing technologies, and works closely with technology partners and vendors to ensure that the team's listings get maximum exposure in the local marketplace. With Michael's experience and assistance, and under Robin's expert leadership, the Gordon team has achieved over $1.25 billion in career sales and exceeded $159 million in sales in 2014. Now, let's welcome Michael to the call as we join our host, Tim Harris.
So, listeners, this is a bit of a homecoming for me, this radio interview, because Michael Gordon and his wife, Robin, were one of my personal first coaching clients back in the late 90s or whenever it was. And it's fun sharing and having Michael be gracious enough to set aside 30 minutes of his day to share with you the success that he's experienced. A lot of you are wondering how big can you make your practice? How much, like, what's the real potential of your real estate business? And let's just get down to the heart of it. How much money can you possibly be making? And the thing that you're about to learn is that Michael and his wife, Robin, think huge, not just big, but huge. And as a result of that, they're making literally in personal income millions and millions of dollars per year. And I'm sure Michael won't want to, drill down on that too much because it's, kind of tacky. But the reality of it is that in the country, there's probably very few agents that, A, make as much money as they do in gross commission, but more importantly, B, net as much in personal income as Michael and Robin Gordon. So I want you not just to listen to what he's saying as far as marketing ideas, as far as things that will make you guys say just, wow, I know a lot of you are going to be really inspired by what he has to say, but I want you to be paying extra close attention to the fact that every single thing that Michael says always drives back down to the most important thing in running a business, and that is profit. It's not, we're not going to talk a lot about team building. We're not going to talk a lot about the rah-rah stuff that's very popular when you go to real estate events. You're going to be hearing from a real, honest-to-God business person who happens to be in the real estate business. So without any further delay, Michael, welcome to today's radio show.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate those kind words.
Yeah. It is interesting that a lot of agents they set limits on themselves, right? They set self-imposed limitations on what they're able to do in their lives. And, maybe it's the type of homes that they sell, maybe it's the, income they can earn, maybe it's the lifestyle that they feel comfortable experiencing. Did you ever have similar limitations when you and Robin were first getting started years and years and years ago?
I don't really think I had those limitations. I think that I started with something that's common among a lot of top-producing people. And that is a chip on my shoulder. That is to say that I think a lot of people that do very well at some point in their life were told that they never could, or that there was something about them that might prevent them from achieving big things. And so I always sort of had that feeling that when I grew up, I was in an area where it was very wealthy, and I wasn't one of the wealthy people. So I looked at myself as someone who wasn't as smart, wasn't as affluent, was sort of not as good as some of these others. And so I developed this chip, and it caused me to work harder than anybody else around me. And I think that that motivated me to, and I don't know if it's fear or whether it was just competitiveness, but I think that motivates me even today. And so I didn't think small. I always thought big.
You know, it occurs to me, we better be enlightening. First of all, not a lot of people, Michael, and I know you're aware of this, outside of the East Coast are aware of the, I don't know what you want to call it, generational wealth that exists uniquely on the West Coast, maybe other places like West Palm or Palm Beach, not West Palm, but Palm Beach. And, you know, outside of that part of the country, there really aren't very many dynasty wealthy type families as there are where you live. So you grew up in an environment where it was people that had made their money, maybe brought money to the United States from Europe when they originally settled here, people that were part that had made their monies originally in the Industrial Revolution, you know, back in the days of Rockefeller and things like that. I mean, that was, you know, in extended family types, those are the types of people that you rub shoulders with. And so in that environment, listeners, he was dealing with about the most embedded, I would say, highest possible wall that you could possibly ever have to climb over, because generally speaking, people in that stratosphere where, you know, Michael originally taught me this saying for ages and ages ago, you know, where the air is truly rare, those people are very inclusive. They don't like to, in the sense that they don't allow outsiders in. So it wasn't just
the insular. Insular.
Thank you. There's another good word. I'll be using that one too. So the reality, but the reality of it is, Michael, is you and Robin, not just you had to break into a very closed, almost caste system. And how did you do it? I mean, do you remember back to the years when you're? Go ahead.
I have to tell you, I was lucky, and my timing was great, because when I got involved in the business, there were a couple things about it that I don't think are true today. And some of these things are true today, but first, at the time, there were really very little, if no, barriers to entry. At the time, the occupation wasn't perceived as remunerative, and there was very little occupational prestige associated with being a realtor. So as a result, I don't think back then it attracted the best and the brightest talent. But enter Bravo TV and reality TV, with their portrayal of the Ferrari-driving, Brioni-suit-wearing agent making $150,000 a deal with little aggravation. And I think what happened is reality TV glamorized the occupation, and with it has brought significant new competition to the industry. And today, these new entrants are just, they're well-financed, they're treating it like a huge business, using technology and sophisticated systems to really scale their practice. So the result is that this competition now has never been more intense. Fortunately, I was lucky, and I got involved at a time when I don't think it was nearly as competitive then as it is now. Also, I got in right before the boom in 2004 and 2005 and 2006. So I think the timing was good for a number of reasons. I think today, if I were to start now, I think I'd have a much more difficult time.
It's interesting you should say that, because we've been observing that too in new coaching clients there, and we tell the listeners that all the time. It's not like it was. You're right, Michael. It's not like it was 20 years ago, where basically it was like, if you can't get a job anywhere, you know, if you don't necessarily have the best resume, you know, you get a real estate license. And if you look at kind of the history of real estate agents, it's kind of a lot of people that didn't necessarily fit into any other industry and or, you know, part-timers. And you're right, it is definitely, definitely changing. People are coming to the business with money, too. That's the other thing that's interesting. They're entering this business seeing it as a business opposed to the way it was in the past. But going back to the original point, because we do have a lot of actual coaching clients and we have a lot of listeners that they know there's this magical city on the hill someplace. They've always wanted to break into that market. And you and Robin did the similar thing, right? You guys were kind of the outsiders, in this little, you know, golden cage environment of the Main Line and the Philadelphia area. We didn't tell them where you sell real estate. Tell them where you sell real estate.
We concentrate on an area that's called the Main Line. And the Main Line is a series of towns where the railroad was developed, and there were a lot of moneyed railroad and other executives that built huge estates in this area that have since been carved up. But these are people that were descendants of the Mayflower. So there's a combination of old money and new money. And what we did is back when in 2003 and 2004, when money was available, and we got involved with representing builders doing one-off new construction. And we had quite a few builders at the time, and that enabled us to really get started on the luxury side. Now, that has since dried up. There isn't that same kind of construction going on in our area to the extent that it was back then. But I think that was a huge opportunity for us at the time.
What were the biggest obstacles when you were having to sit in front of Mr. and Mrs. Mayflower, fourth generation, very wealthy type, and when they were comparing you against, say, somebody they knew at their private country club, right? Because you were dealing with that. You were dealing with embedded agents who basically had familial ties to a lot of these sellers. They came from the same – again, a lot of people in the country, Michael, and I hope you – I mean, maybe you're not – you are aware that the environment that's on the East Coast is unique to the East Coast, the sort of very you know, Anglophile-type world where basically you are from a wealthy family or you're not.
Right,
the bourgeoisie and the proletariat-type thing. That doesn't really exist in other places. So – when you were sitting in front of these people that are sort of the aristocratic old, you know, American families, how did you overcome the fact that you were not from that environment? Or were they actually welcoming of somebody who did have a little bit more of an entrepreneurial digger?
I think that's the case. I think that these folks were just looking for somebody who could achieve results. And, you know, certainly they're – you know, the country club agent who does a few deals a year had the inside track, but a lot of the deals that we were doing were ones where we were in competition and we just had to flat out go in and make a pitch, and convince them that we could get the job done. There wasn't any magic bullets. Now I have to say that my wife was Ivy League educated. She went to the University of Pennsylvania. She went to private schools, and her background was a little bit more of a pedigree type background than mine. She grew up with more money, and she was a little bit more connected. Not at the level of the people we were talking to, but still, that helped us. That helped us from really seeming like an outsider.
There was a great interview, Elon Musk, by the way, great interviews all over YouTube with him. And I watched something just the other day, and he was talking about, someone asked the question, like, so what's the key to being successful? And he just broke it down in the most simplistic of forms. He said, most people work on the outside 50 hours a week. He said, so if your competitor is working 50 hours a week and taking the weekends off and not working the evenings, and you work 100 hours a week, assuming all things equal, you, just from the very fact that you're outworking them, will win. Is that how you guys did it?
Sure. We did it with hard work. At the time, I remember Robin had a pager. And so she was, you know, she would get paid. She would immediately get back to people. And these prospects were so impressed with that. I think skills matter. And if you're able to get the job done, if you're able to perform and you're able to show results that you've gotten for others, I think that you know, I think that carries it. I relationships are important, and relationships can get your foot in the door. But I think that you still have to. The litmus test is what you've done and how you've performed. So we were able to convince prospects that we could get the job done.
How did you do that? Give us some specifics. How did you convince them?
We convinced them with track record. We convinced them with with sales that we were able to achieve, and demonstrate our success in that way. It's been a while. I can't remember the details of exactly what we said, but I think the results were what. You know, and they might not have been a lot of deals at the time, but those that we got were important, and we were able to convince them that we could concentrate on them, make them a priority, not delegate them, and convince them that we were going to treat this as a business.
You said something in particular that I think is worth drilling down on. You said one of the reasons why you feel maybe one of the elements, main elements to your success and Robin's success has been your feeling that you were a bit of an outsider, and as a result of that you had to work a little bit harder to be a little bit more strategic. Can you drill down on that a little bit more? Because I think that honestly that resonates with probably every single one of our listeners.
Well, I don't know that my motivation came so much from being an outsider. I think rather it came from this chip on my shoulder, in that I had someone in my life who told me that I needed to only count on myself. I couldn't count on others. I couldn't rely on others to do anything, and I couldn't depend on them. So I think that I came from this background of scarcity, and so I think that I was super motivated and super competitive to make sure that I never would have that problem, that I would overcome this chip that I have. So I don't think it was so much being an outsider to the area, because I've lived in this area my whole life, and so is Robin. So I think that's where I was coming from.
Right. No, I'm sorry if I used the word outsider. That's what I mean. But in terms of essentially being part of the establishment, because you're now selling the houses that the establishment live in, and that's not necessarily something that happened organically. You had to basically work your way into that. It wasn't given to you. I know when Julie and I sold real estate, as you will remember, we sold real estate in an area called New Albany Country Club. And in that particular area, the real estate market, as was the case with yours, was dominated by people that basically had most of their listing business from social connections or religious connections. In other words, they were connected, and we are the interlopers, we are the outsiders. So in order for us to get dominance in that market, we had to do what you guys did, which is basically outwork them. And at the end of the day, that's what won the day. The next thing you said from yesterday is
well, let me address that also.
Really,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me just address this. One of the things that happened was at that time was that we have three young children, and they were attending schools, and the schools were in a small geographic market area, and so we combined the idea of let's do some targeted direct mail to those areas where these families lived. And I think that the combination of the geographic farming and that relationship marketing sort of bolstered our results. And so when you have young children, there's an affinity for the families. The kids participate in activities after school. They do soccer. They do dance. They do those things. So you have a chance to interact with these families. And if you're visible in the mailbox and you're visible in person, new relationships are developed. So I think we were able to sort of network our way through the relationships that we developed with our kids at the time.
Okay, well, you're actually making it a perfect time for me to pivot and talk about marketing and lead generation, because that's what a lot of people want to know. So you mentioned postcards. You mentioned working social networks, and I don't mean the online variety. You mentioned you're working within the communities of the schools and the sports activities and the other things. So drill down. Let them know. So let's assume, Michael, we're talking with folks that want to be like Michael and Robin, right? They want to be like you guys. They want to be making millions and millions of dollars in personal income. They want to have the lifestyle you have. They want to have the success you've had. But they don't want to take as long as you guys have taken to do it. Not like you've taken that long, 10 years. But still, they want to do it quicker. What would be the three or maybe four primary spokes or sources of business that they would want to focus on if they're wanting to sell in high-end or, in your market, ultra-high-end markets?
Well, I would what I would do is I would identify a targeted area that that had a reasonable amount of turnover where there was no one dominant agent. And that may or may not be possible, but I think I would start there. And I would have a multi-pronged approach with respect to marketing. I would, as I suggested, I would be in the mailbox, and I would do a variety of things from just listed, just sold, to market reports to demonstrate your success and local market expertise. And at the same time, I would do everything I could to be visible to those very people that you were mailing to. I would at the same time start to explore online lead opportunities through a variety of different ways.
That's a deep well. So let's just pivot back to what you were just talking about, because promise you I'll get hate email from our listeners if I let you get away with what you just said.
Okay.
So you said you're mailing postcards. They want to know what the postcards are. Be specific. You said you're mailing market data newsletter. I know what you're talking about. But drill down and tell them what you're talking about, because you're not talking – you are talking about pieces that look beautiful, that are professionally designed, that aren't being provided by your broker, that were that have established a high-end looking brand for you guys. It was unique to Michael and Robin Gordon. But you're not talking about something that's that sophisticated. So let them know, give them some details.
Well, I think simplicity is what it's all about. And I think with direct mail, you have a very short period of time where the recipient is looking at the mail over their trash can. So I think you have to get your point across simply and quickly and only make a couple of points. So the points we try to make is demonstrating our success through just sold, for example, where we'll indicate three or four homes that we sold in the area. We indicate a short blurb about our specific results for that particular sale, like, for example, sold for 98% of asking in just 18 days.
There you
go.
Mike, just stop there for a second. Listeners, I hope you paid attention to what he just said. A just sold by itself doesn't mean bunk. He is saying, we just sold this house, and we sold it, by the way, in 18 days. And then he told them why that was important, versus the average days in the market, which is, say, 47. So he's not just saying we sold it. He's explaining to potential sellers why what he just sold was worth them paying extra attention to. They sold it quicker. Then the next thing you guys heard him say is he was talking about list-to-sell price ratio. Our house, this property sold at, 99.9% or whatever it was of the original asking price versus the average in the marketplace, which might be only 96 or 97%. So it's not okay just to tell them sold. You have to tell them why they should care, that you sold it, what makes that sale unique. Otherwise, as they're hovering over the trash can, it's not even going to get read. But if you have the statistical information that's showing why you're better, why you're the better choice, or at least they should consider you, that's the type of information that's compelling. Excellent, Michael. Any other little suggestions on the
other
postcard specifically?
Yes, the other thing that we do on that postcard is we include a testimonial for one of the sellers whose homes were sold that we're featuring. So we have multiple homes that we're presenting with a blurb about each one that describes the result. A testimonial, and on the most recent campaign, we added something new, and we've added a tagline that says "Robin sold it." So on the postcard, it says "Robin sold it," and we've been including that on our signage as well. A similar kind of round circle on the sign that says "Robin sold it." And even in the high end, it's interesting. We're starting to get a lot of traction with that, where people are repeating that line to us. We go into a listing appointment, and they say, I want a Robin sold it on our sign someday. So it's funny the way little, simple tends to work.
But don't you think it's also, listeners, hear what he just said. Simple works. Make your message quick and succinctly and obviously effectively. But also, don't be fearful of little gimmicky things like what he just said, because at the end of the day, what's the most important thing to any seller, Michael? What is it that they're looking for ultimately?
The highest price, the most favorable terms, and the least aggravation.
And the sign that says sold, right?
Sold.
At the end of the day,
yeah.
That's what they're hiring you to do. And
sure.
Listeners, don't confuse a service with a result. That's the other thing that I know a lot of agents do, is they'll try to sell the service, but ultimately what the seller wants is a result. Don't be confused about that. If you're going to spend, if you think they're buying you because of the wonderful team and your service and all the rest of it, trust me when I tell you, that is maybe 10% of the decision. The rest of it, 90% of the decision, is your track record, or at least their confidence that you can deliver the result. So that's what Michael's Cards does and his direct mail does. So, you know, they're buying the result. They're not buying the service. Don't forget that. Newsletter. You do a newsletter still, correct? Yes?
Yes, yes. Well, what it's actually morphed into is a quarterly report, which doesn't present a lot of statistical detail, because I found that wasn't being received very well, but rather it's our interpretation of what the numbers say. So what we do is we evaluate the numbers and we say, in our market, this is what's happening, this is the trend, and we find that to be more well received by the recipients.
I'm sure, because you're translating the data and you're showing that you guys are an expert, and it's not just some cut and paste from some, punched out newsletter that a lot of agents use. So postcards. These are jumbo postcards. They're on, if I'm remembering correctly, like 80-pound gloss stock. They're like, what, 5x7 or what's the –
They're actually large. They're larger than that now. The post office allows for a larger size than I can't remember the exact dimensions, but I was doing smaller cards and I found out that a larger size would not increase the cost of the postage. So I increased the size to the maximum I could, and still have the same postage cost.
So let's go postal nerd on these guys.
Yep.
Carrier route sorted is what he's talking about. So you guys just Google that and research it on your own. But he's direct mailing to a carrier route, which does make it so your postal rate is less. There's some they treat the carrier route stuff like they treat catalogs, which in other words means they can deliver it when they get around to it. So it's not as consistent as a first-class stamp. So research that on your own. Okay, so the larger format is important. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the key area that you just mentioned is that focusing on a geographic area where you're concentrating on a specific area is really important. So not only do you get the most cost-effective rate for the mailing, but it maximizes your results to concentrate in an area where ultimately you'll have sale signs, you'll have sold signs, and that local market will see. Pardon me?
Right. It's reinforcing. The postcards
yes.
are reinforcing the personal contact, are reinforcing the sold signs, are reinforcing they seeing you guys volunteering it. It's all basically kind of a tartan of success. And I want to show all of the elements to that. So let me drill down these extra points. A larger format postcard, I'll answer the question I was asking you, are important, listeners, because if you have a larger format postcard and they take all their mail out of their box and it's just a normal postcard, it's going to hide behind their utility bill and it will get tossed. They just won't pay attention to it, or it'll slip inside a catalog or some other something, so they won't pay attention to it. But a larger format card is beneficial because literally it's just bigger. And bigger means you're going to increase your likelihood that they're going to see it. So there's that. How many postcards do you mail out per month?
We're doing right now about 15,000.
Okay. You didn't start out at 15,000, though.
No, I started, you eat the elephant one bite at a time. So I think we started at somewhere around 5,000. We focused on that smaller, area that we tried to, dominate and get as much traction, and then scaled it larger with time.
So the cost per – how frequently do you mail, and what's the cost per card all in?
All in, I think it runs around 20, 29 cents or so. all in. I'm printing a year's worth of cards. And,
ahead of time.
So that way I don't have to, you know, constantly deal with it. And so, you know, we're sending them about once a month.
Okay, so you're talking about spending on average less than $5,000 a month to mail 15,000 cards. Did I do the math correctly?
Yep, that's right.
Okay, all right, so let's hover there for a second, listeners. The actual number is 4350. So he's talking about something that's unique, that's, you know, it just his. One of the things Michael's always done well, he's not going to give himself credit for this, is he and Robin have a fantastic eye for design. And the cards themselves are beautiful. The logo they have is, I don't know how much you've changed it since, you know, past over the years, but the way that their marketing looks made it so that all their competitor stuff looked like it was from the 1970s. So it was elegant. It was modern. It was classy without being brash. And, you know, there's a balance to all that. He hired a boutique design firm out of New York City to come up with this. Now, this was back before you had companies that, you know, or have proliferated the marketplace, all these Elance types that will go out and do some great design work for you for nothing. But he spent originally, now this was, you know, years and years ago, he spent originally tens of thousands of dollars to get all this stuff right. The advantage that all of you have, listeners, is that you can find folks like Michael that are selling real estate at a high level, and you can kind of emulate their designs. I know you love me saying that, but it's still true, you know.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you do a little bit of that too. I mean, you're paying attention to what top producers are doing, and you're doing a little copying yourself, yes?
Tim, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel.
Amen, brother. Nicely said, right? Well, you remember that Chinese proverb, right? A smart man learns from his mistakes. A brilliant man learns from the mistakes of others. The nice thing about real estate is we have so many great examples of things, of mistakes that we can avoid if we just pay attention to it. All right, so that's the direct mail piece. I think listeners will be surprised how effective it is. How long did it take for you to actually start getting any kind of traction doing direct mail? Was it right away, or did it take a year? Or how long did it take?
It was surprising. In fact, I remember when we sent out our first cards, not getting any response at all, and I called the advertising agency wondering if the cards were actually sent, because I couldn't believe we got no response. But it actually is sort of like, you know, you're making a long-term commitment to this, and it takes a while. I think it took at least a year before we started to see any results at all. So if you're going to select a geographic farm, pick a size that you can afford to stick with it and be persistent for that period of time before you get results.
Well, you said something else, right, which is really important, and I shouldn't have let it get by. You need to drill down on where you're going to mail. Michael started to talk about doing some MLS homework ahead of time, knowing what your headwinds are going to be in terms of your competitors. And generally speaking, Michael, it's very rare to find a market where there isn't a real dominant number one and number two agent. But what you'll find, guys, when you get in the MLS is the number one agent will usually be doing twice the production of whatever number two and three are. But that still doesn't mean that those markets still can't be attacked by a fresh approach. Because what happens is, especially in small enclaves like where Michael works, I mean small with quotes around it, the sellers actually kind of get burned out on having so few choices, so few options. Yet, you know, they'll actually look for somebody that's doing something different, you know, taking a more maybe aggressive isn't the right word, but a different approach to how to get homes sold. And then another thing that you should be strategic about is choosing an area where there is turnover. There's certain areas where people just don't move. Well, mailing postcards there is just dumb. And there's, you know, you look for the days in the market. You want to know the macro trends that are affecting that market. You want to know that, for example, if you're going to start investing real dollars into a particular geographic area with direct mail, that it's going to be viable 24, 36 months from now. So you might want to look at the employment trends in the area. You might want to make sure that there's nothing that's going to make that particular community you're thinking about farming look obsolete in comparison to, say, a new construction area that's going in across town. That happened in our market in Columbus, Ohio. There was this beautiful area called Muirfield, but when New Albany started getting developed, it was clear on the other end of town. It started to, you know, basically suck the sales out of Muirfield. So be very, very strategic before you start doing direct mail. And then when you do, you got to buckle down and look at it as a long-term commitment that you're not going to get any sort of benefit from for at least 12 months. You might get lucky, But for the most part, that's really how it works. It's not, you know, it's an investment. I like how Michael said that. All right, so, Michael, let's talk about other sources of business for you. And please don't just say, I network, okay? Don't be general. Be specific. Drill down. If you, again, you're someone's wanting to emulate your success, they want to accomplish, you know, what you guys have accomplished in half the time, they can only choose 3 to 5 things. First thing you said you'd suggest that they do is direct mail. What's next?
Well, we had a lot of success with open houses. And interestingly, there is an opportunity to not only pick up buyers, but also sellers as well. Because we found that sellers are out in the neighborhood looking at homes to try to find they're looking at competitive homes because they're going to put their house up on the market, so they want to see what the competition is. But then they start to meet the realtors. And so we found that we met a lot of prospective sellers through that approach. The other thing that we did was we did sneak preview neighborhood open houses. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, Tim.
Sure, of course, but describe to the listeners.
Okay, so the sneak preview neighborhood open house was an open house which occurred before the regular open house, and we invited the neighbors to the house with a thought that perhaps they might have someone who would be interested in that particular house because they're so fond of the neighborhood. But it also gave us a chance to meet them under really favorable circumstances. So again, this was a way to network with these, you know, with these local people who were in our, you know, geographic farm under the most favorable circumstances possible. So I think open houses were very important to us to gain traction in the beginning.
Again, half the folks that walk in, generally speaking, and the sneak previews, you're inviting the neighbors, just listen to everything he's saying, guys, and chances are those neighbors, you know, you're establishing a relationship with them, there's some rapport, there's some level of comfort, they're seeing that you're making an extra effort to get the property sold. And, you know, Michael, here's an interesting question. How sheepish are you guys about finding out someone's motivation? A lot of realtors hold themselves back because they're afraid to ask relatively direct question to find out, take the temperature of the actual lead. What's your mindset about that?
Well, I think it's really important to find out what the motivation is, and I think the key question is when. You know, we can talk about, you know, what they want and where they want to be, but the when they want to move is the most critical question of all. And I do know that that the idea of approaching people and sort of being direct might be outside their comfort level, but that's what it's all about. It's asking those kinds of questions and doing it in a professional way, but I think it's critical.
So listeners, for example, when you run across a buyer, you know, there's a his coaching clients, it's actually, I'm going to just message this to you. Use the scripts, at least the first like 7 questions, exactly the way we've written them. The third or fourth question is, by the way, which house in the neighborhood are you thinking about selling? When you're talking with a buyer prospect, make sure you ask that question right off the top. Because what's going to happen is a lot of you guys try to establish rapport, you try to make them like you, you try to find commonalities, you try to fake friend them, right? So in the midst of fake friending them, they know what you're doing. They're not going to want to, 9 times out of 10, they're just going to want to get away from you and get off the phone. So when you first get them on the phone, use the script and ask them, you know, third question down from the script, coaching clients, make sure you use it, is, by the way, which house in the neighborhood are you thinking about selling? You will find, you'll be stunned and amazed how frequently they actually have not necessarily a primary home, but other properties that they are thinking about selling. So, Michael, here's an interesting question challenge I think a lot of our other high-end coaching clients have had on the coast. I mean, this happened in New York. It happened in L.A. during the recession. You know, really at the end of the day, when you're dealing with really high net worth folks, they don't have to sell ever, do they? I mean, there's not really truly a have to sell situation. It's always just a strong desire to sell. True or false?
Yes. I think that's entirely true. And I think with a lot of those very high-end clients, the price is a function of what it's going to take to extricate them from the house. It has nothing to do with market. It has nothing to do with market value.
Well,
it has nothing to do with comps. It has nothing to do with anything, but at what point at which they're willing to let go and move on. And I'll tell you, we have a couple of, you know, I have a competitor or two in my market that have what I consider to be a listing graveyard of properties where these clients are, you know, they have ridiculous prices associated with their homes. And, you know, I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in babysitting somebody over a long period of time who has no motivation to sell. That to me, I have a different deal. I only get paid when I sell the property. I don't get paid when I list it. So I'm not interested in, you know, and the other thing is these list, you know, listings are not like fine wine. They don't improve with age. So I'm not interested in having a listing that's sitting there unsold for a very long period of time, babysitting a seller who wants an unrealistic price to extricate them from the house.
It goes back to pre-qualifying, and really at the end of the day, guys, when you're dealing with high end, they're very rarely is truly a have-to-sell seller. There's not a seller that's getting relocated and they can't afford two house payments. There's not a seller that's worrying about having to, you know, sell the house because they have some financial issue. So when you're dealing with high-end folks and you're trying to motivate them out of, like, you know, the traditional ways you motivate, say, a non-high-end seller, it's not going to work. So you better be sensitive to their financial prowess, and you better be sensitive to their financial fortitude, because they don't have to sell, and they're not going to react positively to you putting those types of pressures on them. So it's a bit of a dance, and it is what Michael said. The deal has to make sense to them. But in many cases, when these guys have multiple homes, actually it makes the process easier because they have other places they can easily transition to. You know, so these are all skill sets you have to develop over time. So in this, Michael, your market, is it a balanced market or is it a strong seller's market like most of the country?
What's interesting is that our market has become very challenging at the high end, and our average sales price has actually declined lately. I think it's as a result of a revitalization of Center City, Philadelphia, where we're finding more and more buyers like the idea of a walk-to location in an urban environment. So what we're finding is what previously we have, you know, either younger people or people that were empty nesters stay in the suburbs. We're finding they're either circling back to the city or staying in the city longer than they had before. So we're getting competition in the suburbs to a revitalized, Center City, Philadelphia.
Someone just reminded me in chat. We promised the listeners three primary lead generation spokes. Do you have another one in mind?
I think online is very important, but I also would encourage everyone to invest, test, and don't guess. I've done that. I've done that with Google AdWords. I've done that with Facebook. And it's important to measure and see exactly what the cost per lead is. I have found with pay-per-click, for example, that it's costing right now about $50 to generate a lead. And industry standard 1% conversion on an internet lead, that's $5,000 for each sale. I think that's unrealistic to generate any kind of return. But I know it's market specific, and some are able to purchase internet leads for less money, depending upon how competitive Google is in your particular area. So, but I do think there's an opportunity in certain markets, for internet leads. So I would pursue that. I would pursue a seller strategy on Facebook and a buyer strategy on AdWords.
Do high-end sellers see a team, generally speaking, as it's presented in the marketplace? Is that seen as an attribute or a detriment in the eyes of the seller?
Detriment.
Stop right there. I want you to re-say, because this is so true, right? And we've had other. So that most Michael and I didn't practice this prior, but it's always the same answer. Listeners, please, please listen. High-end sellers, and I will go as far as to say most experienced sellers, will not see a team as an advantage. It used to be seen as an advantage 10, 15 years ago, but anymore, if you present yourself as a team, they're actually going to prefer somebody who has a different approach, even though that person might have assistance. So I'm handing it back to you to explain.
I find that none of our sellers, none of our clients want to get delegated to someone. The reason they hired us in the first place was because they thought that they were going to get our attention and our expertise. And they get very upset when they feel they're not getting touches from us. I don't care how frequently our assistant reaches out with feedback and with housekeeping issues. They need to hear from us. And if they feel like they're not, they're going to go elsewhere. So I have never advertised ourselves as a team. It's always been, you know, the Robin Gordon brand. I think at the high end, that makes sense. I can't see doing it any other way.
Well, the pendulum swung the other way. That's what's happened. In the marketplace, and a lot of agents aren't aware of this, the pendulum is swinging away from, now we're not saying don't have assistance, don't misunderstand what we're saying, but strictly from a consumer perspective, and yeah, he's dealing with really wealthy homes, really wealthy sellers, really expensive homes, but this is starting to percolate down into the lower ends because people have the perception is I want to deal with the man or the lady who's running the show. I don't want to be delegated. And, you know, there's no elegant way for you to go in there and explain to a seller who's used to getting their way, who goes in there and you said, you know, we were talking Brioni suits and everything yesterday, who's used to walking into Brioni and doesn't just buy off the rack. They actually walk into Brioni and they are shown to the private room in the back. Okay, that's what type of sellers, you know, he's dealing with on a regular basis. Where they go to order their new Ferrari, they don't just walk into the dealership and order a Ferrari. They're, again, shown to a private room. That's what you guys have to understand, what the expectation is of these high-end sellers, and you have to meet them where they are. You know, a lot of agents, Michael, they'll talk about service. I hate that term when I hear people talking about it. Like, I'll say, what is it that you do that's different? Well, I deliver better service. That's an intangible. But what does that mean to you? What is it that a seller receives when they list with Michael and Robin Gordon?
I think communication is the most important important service. Communication is important, but I also think that honesty is important. Honesty is critical. I think it's very important to be completely honest with them about pricing. That's when the sale is made, and so I think that can't be underestimated how important that is. I also think that they can expect us not to avoid confrontation. It's part of the job. So and I also believe there's this huge myth out there that the customer is always right. I don't think the customer is always right. I don't think the seller is always right. The seller often has unrealistic expectations about everything in the process, starting with the price. So I think it's important for us to not be afraid to explain to them exactly what we feel, and those who get it are going to be a good match for us, and those who don't, you know, they can go elsewhere.
So, in a world where people are used to getting their way and calling the shots, how do you subtly take control and then bring them down to the reality of the market without pissing them off?
Well, I think it's a matter of just simply, and I'll address this from a pricing standpoint. It's just a matter of going through comparable sales, and it certainly helps having sold many of the homes, you know, having sold homes in the area where we're speaking from a position of authority. But it's just a matter of being genuine, presenting the data, presenting the comparables, And explaining to the seller what the pricing should be, or with respect to an offer and terms, and describing what the terms are, explaining what's customary and what's not customary. But I think it's just a matter of being genuine and being honest. I think there's too much buying of listings, and too much overpricing. And the sellers are. I just don't think that. I think that's a huge mistake to make for any agent at any point in their career.
In the high end, how much do you have to fight for commissions?
Where we have to fight for commissions is what we've seen an increasing clawback of inspection and repair issues. It's not uncommon for us to see $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 of requests for a seller concession on price as a result of the home inspection issues. So what's been happening is the seller is asking us to take a commission hit to absorb some of that clawback, and that's what we really have to fight for, fight to hold our deal together with respect to our commission.
That's happening in all price ranges. How do you fight against that? Are you doing pre-inspections? Are you sort of laying the groundwork that their deferred maintenance isn't going to be your problem? I mean, how do you set yourself up so you're not going to be set up when it comes time to fix their leaky roof?
It's a matter of managing expectations on the front end, and when you're pitching the listing, we talk about the landmines and hurdles that have to be overcome along the way. You know, one of the landmines that we overcome is the home inspection, and we explain to them what to expect. The other landmine that has to be overcome is the appraisal. So we talk through that while we're pitching the listing, so that the seller has some idea as to what's going to happen throughout the process.
So in a world where you guys are at the top of I don't think you'll agree with this statement, but I'll say it anyway just so you can refute me. In a world where you're at the top of your game, where you guys have climbed the mountain that you set out to climb, about a decade ago, what's next?
Well, one of the things where I think I made a huge mistake, and I would certainly advise newer agents to think through this, but we sell an asset class it's probably one of the best products in the world. It has such opportunities for owners of real estate to make money from appreciation and the tax benefits and the leverage that you get and particularly as a professional investor. I made a mistake by not purchasing rental properties in my career, and so that's what I would like to do. I would like to start to purchase investment properties and take advantage of the local knowledge that we have and start to develop a portfolio of income producing properties. I think
real estate is the ultimate durable good, that's for sure. That's interesting that you said that, too. I think listeners of everything we've talked about the past 2 days, I bet you that's the one that's going to be the most impactful, if you want to know the truth. Because that really can't be – real estate, guys, as an investment vehicle, is second to none. There's nothing – and it doesn't matter. Markets go up, markets go down. But there's no other type of investment where you can – not always, but where you can benefit from the depreciation – from the appreciation, and from the cash flow. There's nothing else like that. A business doesn't necessarily, have all those benefits. That's the argument, right? Well, I started my own business. Well, you know what? You could, but it's, real estate, for the most part, is a passive thing. Stocks don't deliver on all three of those categories. So real estate really is second to none in terms of a way of building long-term wealth. So listeners, listen to what he said. That's fantastic that you were honest about that. Thank you.
And it's true. And it's true of, I don't care how much money you make selling real estate. It's almost impossible to get rich. And I think that's the reason, you've said that realtors don't retire, because they can't. The way you get rich is not by selling the real estate. It's by owning it. And this is true of business owners where, they have a business, they've owned it for 60 years, and they happen to own the real estate. And at the end of the day, the real estate is where, when they sell the real estate, that has more value than the business. So,
you're reminding me of a really funny real estate client I had like 20 years ago. This guy was looking for this really big estate in Columbus. And his way that he built wealth, Michael, is exactly what you just said. In this 70s, he had a bunch of roller skating rinks. You remember those? Roller skating was a passing fad, but he had all the real estate paid for, and so all those roller skating rinks became locations for big box stores. You know, they put a different elevation, and he put all these ridiculous long-term leases to, you know, and that's how he pivoted. Now he became really rich off the paid-off real estate. Yeah, and I like what you said, too. Real estate itself, selling real estate won't make you rich, and rich is where your money works for you and you no longer have to work for your money. You have to reinvest the profits that you make from selling real estate, which gets back to another recurring issue, is if you have no profits from your real estate business, you want to have anything to reinvest, and you'll never be able to build wealth. So it's, you know, these are all little truisms, and it's nice to hear someone at Michael's level telling you guys, reinforcing really the message that we tell you every single day on the radio, because he just hit on three of the high points that we talk about most days. So, Michael, one last question, albeit self-serving, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Coaching, what has it meant to you in your success?
Well, it's so great, Tim, to have seen what you've accomplished, having, you know, been one of your very first coachees. So, but I can say that you were so instrumental to what I've achieved, and I think it gets back to, you know, not reinventing the wheel yourself. I think I was able to get a fast start because I benefited from your experience. And the experience of, you know, of your insight, of your accountability, I don't think we could have gotten the rapid ascension that we did without coaching at that point in our career. So I don't think you can. I think you need to do it right away in your career. I would make that investment. And I know it'll pay off. It certainly did with us.
Well, so you're going to send me 10% of all the revenue you guys have earned for the last 10 years, right? That was the deal we had, right? I don't remember. No.
Well, I remember writing out a check to my competitor if I didn't accomplish something that was, you know.
Oh, I think it was a gal, too, wasn't it?
Exactly.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
It was.
I remember. Well, listen, Michael, we went way over. You've been very generous with your time. I think without knowing it, you're more motivational and more inspirational than you think. I really love the fact that you're at a point where you are really embracing the whole idea of, you know, contribution and giving back to the industry. In my opinion, Michael, and you and Robin, you know, I are living testaments to this, there really is no other business that you can get into as an entrepreneurially minded person that's better than selling homes. Just, I don't even think commercial real estate's not as good. People will argue tech companies and all the rest of it. No. What you guys are doing now, your real estate licenses, you at some point had some inspiration to get your real estate license. This really is an industry without limits. And if you're not experiencing that, if you're not really completely living and loving that mindset, you know, you do need to seriously check yourself on that, because as chances are, it's your mindset that's holding you back from experiencing literally millions and millions of dollars in personal income. When Michael said he and his wife have earned over $1 billion, or have added over $1 billion in home sales, $1.25 billion, something like that, some of you are doing the math in your heads. You're multiplying by 3%. And it is a huge number. And they've done that, guys, in a little less than 10 years. You can do the same thing. Be strategic. Be smart. Take action. That's the most important thing. And as always, if there's anything we can do for you, request a free coaching call. A lot of listeners are starting to reach out, Michael, that are top producing agents. You know, we've been blessed with having some of those top producing agents like yourself for coaching clients. And we're getting a lot more that are pivoting away from maybe some of the coaches they've had for a while. If that's you, I want you to email Julie and I directly at tim@timandjulieharris.com and julie@timandjulieharris.com. And Julie and I are considering, and we probably will, take on 10 private clients each. As a lot of you guys know, we haven't been taking on private clients for years, but we're considering doing it because, frankly, we love doing it and it keeps our skill set frosty. So if you're think you might be a good fit, let us know. And of course, if you're not ready for Julie and I personally, we have what I believe to be some of the best, most talented, sincerely service-minded coaches in the industry who will also be a potentially a great fit for you as well. So, Mr. Michael Gordon, I sincerely appreciate connecting with you. I sincerely appreciate your time on the radio. And you know what? Thanks for being a friend for all these years, too. I appreciate that as well.
Feeling is mutual. Thank you, Tim.
Listeners, we'll talk with you on the radio tomorrow. Don't forget to do as always after every radio show. Please do share this with as many other agents as you can. Let Michael and Robin Gordon's success story be the inspiration for you to build your own dream business. That's what it's all about. Is there anything we can ever do to help? You guys got the information on how to reach out. Have a fantastic day, and we'll talk with you on the radio tomorrow.
This program has been a presentation by Tim and Julie Harris, Real Estate Coaching. For more information on our real estate coaching and training programs, visit our website at timandjulieharris.com. Remember to tune in weekdays at noon for upcoming shows, and until next time, thank you for listening to Real Estate Coaching Radio with Tim and Julie Harris.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.